All right, we remember, I know it's hard to kind of, when you have a week off or a week in between, it's kind of hard to do a survey like this. I want to take us back just a little, but not spend all of our class kind of going over the same ground. Remember that we have called Job chapters 32 through 37, this is my title for this, the Elihu Lectures. And remember that what we've said about this is that this is the period of time when Job's sayings are ended and his friends are, I don't know if they're exasperated or if they just feel there's nothing else to say or if they just are talked out at this point or another. But at this point, we have learned that there has been at least one other person listening in on these conversations, and that his name is Elihu, which I pointed out is the first actually Hebrew name, or what would be regarded as a Hebrew name in this book, and that Elihu is a younger man who has been trying to respect his elders by allowing them to do the talking and so forth, but he has grown weary of it. He has held his peace as long as he can, because he feels like that Job has been treading on ground that he doesn't belong in, especially with what he has had to say about God not being fair with him. And then that he's grown frustrated with Job's friends because he feels like they've tried to explain this in terms of Job's wrongdoing or somehow deserving this, but they haven't convicted him of any wrong. They've suggested it's happened because Job's done wrong, but they haven't showed anything wrong that Job's done. Now, you and I remember that may not be exactly true, because they have, as we've gone along, implied at least some of the things that they thought Job may have, where he may have been wrong. I want to point out to you what may be regarded as the theme for this section of this book. I'll just call your attention to it. I think that when I read this, what strikes me is Elihu's focus on what is right. Let me just call your attention to some of the passages where this shows up. Look at chapter 32 and verse 9. We suggested that in verse 8, where Eliphaz focused on experience, and Bildad focused on tradition, and Zophar focused on common sense, Elihu is suggesting that the real answers to these problems lies in inspiration or in the breath of the Almighty. But look at what he says in verse 9. It's not the old who are wise and not the aged who understand, look at that, what is right. I'm reading from the ESV here, so that idea of what is right. Now, look over with me at chapter 33 and verse 12. 33:12, and notice he says, behold, and this time he's talking to Job, behold, in this you are not right. Do you see that? That seems to be the note that he wants to strike. Look at chapter 34 and 5. For Job has said, I am in the right, and God has taken away my right. You notice the idea that I'm getting at here, what seems to me to be kind of the theme that that this young man deals with here. I think he brings it up with the phrase righteousness also in some time and in some cases, like chapter 35 and verse 7, or at times he uses the word upright to suggest the same kind of theme. Now, I want to suggest to us that what can happen when we're dealing with these questions about how life works, when we look at the orthodox views of God's sovereignty over His world, and how we think it's supposed to work, and then we see the experience of people, when we're young, find the fire burning in us and have convictions, and we want to focus on what is right rather than examining maybe ourselves and whether we're right, and then rather than having some feeling for people and what they're going through. One of the ways maybe that we mellow with age is to kind of focus on persons a little more, and I think that you can see some of that with Elihu here. Now, what does Elihu add to the discussion of this book? Well, Elihu. This whole section here serves the purpose of turning attention toward God. In other words, Elihu's focus on what is right does serve the purpose in this book of turning the attention gradually from Job's arguments and Job's friends' explanations to the majesty and the power and the goodness of God. And one of the things that Elihu adds to this book is the idea that suffering may be, in some cases, allowed, and this is a remarkable observation for this young man, but it's an important one, that it may sometimes be allowed through the goodness of God. I believe that this is the major contribution of the Elihu passages to the book of Job, and it is an observation about the trials that human beings go through that doesn't come very often, as far as I can find, in the Old Testament otherwise. Now, notice how this has to do with the kernel of truth that this book offers. The fact that God believed in His servant Job enough to think that His servant Job could be true to Him and maintain His uprightness even in the face of whatever the enemy might do to him is, in a roundabout way in this book, a reflection of God's goodness. God, who is great and powerful, believes enough in the heart of His children that He believes that their goodness will be sustained even in the face of the most serious challenges, and that's kind of a thought-provoking part of this book. Now, what we did before is to sort of survey chapters 32 and 33 of this book and what Elihu says. I want to point out to you that in chapter 33, Elihu speaks to Job, and what he says is that God may exercise His rule where suffering is regarded in two ways. He may make Himself known in two ways that are important. And I'll say God makes Himself known, I mean God may reveal Himself, or God may work on people. Now, bear in mind, while I'm saying this, I'm not saying this is how it was working with Job. I want you to see what Elihu says about how God exercises his rule in the world. Notice, first off, in verses 14 and 15, one way God speaks is how? Verse 15. All right, in a dream or a vision. I might get a different marker here, or this will only be a vision to you. All right, God may first off make himself known in a vision or a dream. And there have been some of the spokesmen in this book who have claimed that they learned what they knew about how the world works in this way, and in particular, Eliphaz has said that. Now, in verse 17, if God speaks in this way, why does he do it? Verses 17 and 18. All right, to turn men back, or what else? It's the same thing, it just says it a different way. To keep back. In other words, God makes himself known, according to Elihu here, in these hard, tough situations of life. And I think we're to think about this. Here is a tired man, a suffering man, who endures visions or dreams or so forth, and these happen on his bed in order to turn him back from some wrong intention, or to bring him back when he's headed at least in the wrong direction. That's the idea that's here. Now, this young man, this doesn't fit Job, does it? Job was not needing to be turned back from something. He was not needing to be brought back from a mistaken destination. So Elihu is making the mistake the others had, at least here. They take something that God may do for some person at some time and try to make it the rule for how he does it for every person, all the time. And that in itself is a mistake about right. Now, the second way that God makes himself known, according to Elihu in verse 19, is what? All right, in pain. God may make himself known in pain. And Elihu is saying that a man may be rebuked with pain on his bed, so that the result is such that in verse 22, while his soul draws near to the pit, it may be, verse 23, for him an angel or a mediator or one of a thousand to declare to man what is right. And there's that theme again, what is right for him. And he's merciful to him, and he says, deliver him from the pit, and so forth here. And then verse 26. Look, this is Elihu's idea of how it works out. Whether it's a vision or pain, what happens? Look at verse 26. All right, then. Look at this. Man prays to God, and God does what? All right, God accepts him. So this is thought to be, this is thought to have been, notice, a correction or a deliverance from what otherwise might have been disaster. Man prays, God accepts, then God restores that man, and then man can say that God has redeemed my soul. Excuse my writing today, but you see the idea. God has redeemed. Now, Elihu is saying that God is such that this is how he works things out. He may do it in a revelation of some sort, but he may do it in an experience of some sort, which is harsh and difficult. And the way God intends it is for man to pray, God to restore him, and the man to rejoice that God has redeemed him. Now, what in that scheme of things is the breakdown of this? Look at verses 31 and 32. What in that system of thought, where has that broken down in this book?
Starts with, has the man done anything to need correcting?
All right, it starts with that assumption, doesn't it? It starts with the idea that this is always how it happens. It does not make provision for the fact that someone else may be at work injecting pain into human experience. And it makes no allowance for that. Now, Elihu has a high view of God, but he has an insufficient view of pain and of hardship. That's the difficulty. Now, look at verses 31 and 32. 29 through 32 really is important. God does all these, behold, God does all these things, verse 29 says, to bring, in verse 30, to bring back his, that is man's soul from the pit, that he might be lighted with the light of life. Now, there is a view of suffering that the Bible says may, in some cases, be what God does. Hebrews 12, for example, with God's children, he can use chastening to bring holiness about and a deeper regard for holiness in our lives. But that's not the only reason why pain is a part of human experience. Look at verses 31 and 32. How does Elihu regard his motives, his own motives in saying these things? What has he intended to do by making this point? All right, he thinks this would justify Job. How? All right, he would be saying that rather than, as Job's friends have implied, rather than this being because Job has already got off into some wickedness that he needs to repent of, Elihu's giving him the benefit of the doubt, and he's saying Job hasn't necessarily done anything yet, but God may be keeping him from it, may be trying to keep him from it. So I suppose that's small comfort, but maybe it would be some comfort at least. Now, look with me where it goes next. This passage, let's begin to make ourselves a list of the view of God that develops in this passage here. The first thing now that we're learning about God is that God is good and therefore may use these things to turn people from or to bring people back from their problems. Now, chapter 34 now takes another step in the argument. This time what Elihu does is to deal with Job's words in view of what he has had to say about God so far. And what he says is, verse 34, he wants to talk to these wise men, and he says, let us choose what is right. I'll notice that point again about what is right. It's come up, it came up in verse 23 of chapter 33, and now again in verse 4, chapter 34. Job has said, verse 5, what? So how has Elihu understood Job's main point as he has listened in on this conversation? All right, Job has been saying, I feel like I have been afflicted unjustly, and that I have cried out to God for someone to stand between us and to decide what is just between us, and I feel like I'm getting no answer. And Elihu has understood Job not to be talking about himself, but only to be talking about God. Of course, Job has been talking about God, but because of what he has been going through. So he's heard Job saying, God has taken away my right. In spite of my right, I'm counted a liar. My wound is incurable, even though I'm without transgression. What application has he made of that? Look at verses 7, 8, and 9 of Job 34. Randy, read those for us, please.
What man is like Job? He dreams up, scoffing like water. He travels in company with people doers and walks with wicked men. For he has said, it profits a man nothing that he should take delight in God.
All right, so Elihu's concern about what Job has said is that Job is scoffing by saying that it does not profit anybody to take delight in God. In other words, it does no good to love God or to serve God or to worship Him. That is the concern that Elihu has, is that Job has gotten too close to saying that there's no use in serving God. All right? And Elihu now, in the rest of this chapter, is going to respond to that problem as he has heard it. And what he's going to argue is an outgrowth of this first point, and that is that God will not pervert justice. All right, that idea. All right. In order for us to survey this, let me call your attention to some of the key verses of this passage. Verse 10, therefore hear me, you men of understanding, be it far from God that he should do wickedness, and from the Almighty that he should do wrong. For according to the work of a man, he will repay him, and according to his ways, he will make it befall him. All right, what is Elihu's view of how God makes life work? Notice carefully that Elihu takes what the Bible teaches will happen at the end when the Lord comes again. That is, God will render to each man according to his works, that we all will appear before the judgment seat of Christ to receive the things done in our bodies, whether it be good or bad. Each one of us giving account to God to the things that we've done, or the things we've done, whether they're right or wrong. And Elihu makes that to be the law for how things work all the time throughout life, right? Now, if you see the point I'm getting at here, the statement he makes at the end of verse 11 may be true in judgment, but it's not always true in current events. That makes sense. Okay. Now, verse 12, he argues, of a truth, God will not do wickedly, and the Almighty will not pervert justice. He says, if God, and this is my summary of verses 13 through 15, if God wanted to pervert justice, he could, and he could wipe out everybody that he's made because it's his creation. He says if God did pervert justice, He could not be the moral ruler of the world, verse 17. Somebody who hates justice could not govern the world as God does. Verse 21, God has his eyes on the ways of man. He sees all his steps. Verse 25, he knows their works. He overturns them in the night. They're crushed, that is, if they're wickedness. But then verse 27, because they turned aside from following him and had no regard for his ways. He's talking about the wickedness. God deals with them by bringing these hardships, he says. Verse 30, that a godless man should not reign. And the idea for that whole section is that God deals with human beings and his providence in such a way that he knows he can overturn their works because of what they've done in order to keep wickedness from winning. And in general, that's true again, but we have the problem of how it applies to Job. So verse 31 and 32, he argues that Job should have said, verse 31, I've borne a punishment, I will not offend anymore. Teach me what I do not see. If I have done iniquity, I will do it no more. I think he means to say that Job should have said that instead of arguing he hadn't done anything to deserve this. He's saying that if Job had shown a more humble and submissive attitude, then he would have found relief from what he was going through. So verse 35 and 36, Job speaks without knowledge. His words are without insight. Would that Job were tried to the end, because he answers like wicked men. For he adds what? Rebellion to his sin. And he multiplies his words against God. That's the idea. That's the conclusion that Elihu has come to. He was somewhat right, wasn't he? In some ways he was right. Where he was lacking is that he had very little sympathy for what Job had gone through, and he still was drawing a conclusion that where not every plank in his platform belonged there. It didn't fit Job, Brother Petey.
We look at those three friends, and we look at Elihu, and all of these had come up with false premises.
Yes.
And that's where it all goes wrong.
Yes.
Our sickness and problems and troubles don't come generally from God. In this case, it was allowed by God.
But caused by the devil.
Yes.
Yes.
Jesus said, they that are sick need a physician. And if not, we go to over-the-counter stuff, Tylenol and Aleve and whatever, to get some relief from whatever we might have. Mm-hmm. But we don't go through experiences like our three friends here.
That's or right.
Life.
That's right. And fortunately, it's the case that what Job is going through is the extraordinary degree of human suffering. That does not belittle any human suffering, but it does say, and what Brother Feeney's the point he makes is a very important one, that they assumed that everything that happened here was caused by God and deserved by the people, and that's just not the case at all. They're struggling with the problem. Now, Elihu, where in chapter 33 he meant to justify Job, notice that in chapter 34 he means to justify God. He wants to say that God doesn't pervert justice, and that Job needs to learn from this and to be disciplined from it, instead of thinking that he can that he's in some sort of contest he needs to win. Now, let me quickly ask you to look at chapter 35. He's still talking to Job here, and his problems are now with Job, that he thinks that Job has thought that he had some kind of right before God that he hasn't received. And notice verse 4, Elihu is going to answer both Job and his friends here. He wants them to look at the heavens and to think that even if their arguments, were heard and were right, how do they think they could correct God in that process? How do they think that they can somehow justify God? If they were righteous, what would that give to God? Verse 7, what would they receive from his hand? Verse 8, the multitude of people cries out to the Almighty, but none says, where is God my maker, who gives songs in the night and teaches us more than the beasts of the earth and makes us wiser than the birds of the heaven? And I'd like you to notice what he's saying there. And it's a thought that we've hit on before. What he's saying here is that God is not thanked enough for the good. In other words, he says that we spend our time in human experience asking ourselves, why do bad things happen to good people? And we very seldom, if ever, ask, why do good things happen to any of us? God is not regarded enough, he says, as our maker, as the one who gives us songs to rejoice over, and as the one who teaches us and gives us privileges to have dominion over his earth and all the beasts and so forth that he makes. And Elihu says we are in danger here of pride, and that God does not hear an empty cry. He's not someone who is absent from life and detached from it, but that he is the giver of every good and perfect gift. So that's my summary of what Elihu is saying. So again, he convicts Job with empty talk as this chapter ends. All right, now, I wanted to get the thought of chapter 36 and 37 done. I'm not sure we're going to be able to do that completely, but let me just ask you to notice the main thoughts from these two chapters. The first one, if you'll notice, he points out in chapter 36 here God's greatness. And the idea, if there's one verse that sums it up, might be verse 22, God is exalted in power. That point he makes in chapter, in verse 22, but also verse 26, God is great and we know him not. Elihu is getting closer and closer to the truth. He says in verse 24, we should remember to extol his voice. And then verse 37, chapter 37, his point is that God is exalted in majesty. So I'll use the word majestic here. We should keep listening to his voice in the thunder. We should stop and consider the wondrous works of God. Verse 14, the things he does for the correction of his land or his love for people. Verse 13, and then we come to verses 22 and 23. By the way, in verse 5, he says God does great things we cannot comprehend. He's getting close to the truth. Verse 22 and 23. Out of the north comes golden splendor. God is clothed with awesome majesty. The Almighty, we cannot find him. He is great in power, justice, and abundant righteousness. He will not violate. Therefore, men fear him. Now, What Elihu has done is to open the way for God to speak. And he has gotten to the place where he has said, God is majestic, we don't understand, we don't know the whole story. That is, to me, his emphasis on God's goodness here and here opens the way for this thought, and he gets closer to the truth than we've gotten so far in this book in that way. We'll touch on this a little bit, but now we're going to listen to God talk the next couple chapters. And Brother Feeney mentioned to me before class, this gets closer to Genesis 1 and 2 than any other part of the Bible may do. So be reading through that, and thank you for being with us today. Everybody have a great week.